All right, welcome back to the Coach Mark Gottfried Show. I've had a long list of amazing guests and great stories to tell, but we're going to have fun today because I got a good friend who I think is one of the most respected guys I came across as an NBA executive, former general manager of the Washington Wizards, Tommy Shepard. Man, Tommy, it's great to have you on the show. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Hey, Coach, that California life's doing you good. You look great. Thank you for having me on today.
So let's go all the way back, Tommy. I'm really interested, and those people that know you well will know some of this, but, you know, just kind of doing a little background on you. But, you know, growing up in New Mexico, so here you are, you're a young guy. If I get this, I hope I don't get this wrong, but you're a young guy. Did you ever at that point, you know, as a youngster, high school, college, did you ever have the vision that one day I'm going to be a general manager in the NBA?
Well, I tell you, it all started when I was six, and I just wanted to be Julius Erving. And I told my parents I wanted to play in the NBA. And my dad taught me how to read box scores so I could see Julius's name in the paper 2 days after he played, obviously, when he was with the Sixers. But that was my entire life when I first saw him. I said, I want to play in the NBA. Got to high school and realized that's probably not going to happen. But what happens is life, you know, I just got lucky. A series of events. When I graduated from New Mexico State, I got to UNLV. I worked for Coach Tarkanian, worked for Coach Massimino. Got a lucky break, got to the Denver Nuggets as a PR guy. And then, you know, just you kind of keep your head down and keep marching. But I always knew I wanted to run a team. And I give so much credit to Bernie Bickerstaff, kind of gave me my first job with the Nuggets, and I told him, I said, man, one day I'd love to run a team. And he gave me so much opportunity back then. There were so many jobs that need to get done and not enough people. So that's really what turned me that way. But, you know, there's a difference between a wish and a dream, I guess. Sometimes the wish is you always just keep repeating to yourself. But a dream, you say, hey, man, I've had a lot of dreams come true, and you keep marching towards it. And that's what happened. I got lucky as hell, but I sure enjoyed my ride. It was a great time.
Tommy, talk a little bit about, because we've all had people along the way, you know, and you mentioned a couple guys that, you know, highly respected guys, you know, you were able to be around as, when you were younger. But talk about some of the influence that, you know, maybe a guy like Tark at UNLV, who, you know, I always had the greatest respect for him. But just that staff, and then Raleigh came in there, and then your time at Denver, but just the people that kind of helped you along the way as you kind of, you know, made your moves in your profession.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't even start my story without Tim Gergerich. You know, when I got to work for Jerry Tarkanian, it was his final season at UNLV, and it was very, very end of a very long litigation with the NCAA. It was awful. What that happened to Coach Tark is never going to be forgiven by a lot of people in Vegas. But I will promise you this, he was one of the greatest coaches in the world. And most of the reason was certainly his acumen, but the people around him were phenomenal. And Tim Gergerich was, that was my biggest influence by far. The way he treated one like 12 and 12 like one, Coach. And everybody demanded so much of every player, but he gave them all the love and gave them all the confidence and never quit on guys. And that resonated with me. And then when Rolly came in, Rolly was fantastic. God bless Coach Mass. You know, there's two guys who won championships, totally different coaches. But I would say this, Rolly had an assistant coach too, just like Coach Tark, that had a huge influence in my life, was Jay Wright. And I remember, that was before I was married, and Jay had babies, and my soon-to-be wife was a swimmer at UNLV, my girlfriend, and she was babysitting for Jay. And he just made such a huge impression on me, the way he recruited, the way he treated players, the way he knew the game, but he could put all the pieces together and was such a sincere, great guy. So those two, you know, between Gerg and Jay Wright, those are two of my biggest influences as a young age in basketball. Working for Tark and Mass was great. Then I got to Denver, and having Bernie Bickerstaff, your first guy, first day, was tremendous. You know, Bernie to this day still gives back to the game, and one of the most incredible human beings I've ever met. So, you know, I feel like a lot of times now how lucky you are on your journey, because if it hadn't been for this person or that person, maybe your journey turns out completely different. And then, you know, when I was in Denver, a lot of people came across my life, and I appreciate all of them. And then when I got to D.C., Ernie Grunfeld absolutely gave me the job of a lifetime and a chance of a lifetime to be an assistant GM with the Wizards. And then when I was promoted unfortunately, somebody had to leave, and Ernie left the door, and I was promoted into that seat and loved it. A great, great opportunity, and there's nothing like the NBA. I promise
The
you that,
best.
coach.
The best.
Yeah, too
Talk a
much
little bit
fun.
about, because I'm curious, you're there at UNLV and you're younger at that time, but I maybe the question is how was it to learn from two coaches and coaching staffs that were completely different and both were good? I mean, you look at Tark and Gerg and Mark Workantine and that whole crew, they were so good, and Gerg was, he might be one of the best on-court teachers I've ever been around. And then, here comes Rolly and Jay, and Jay and I are great friends. We coached our Pan Am team, I think it was 2006, down in Rio de Janeiro. But different styles, and here you are kind of observing that. What did you learn from that as watching that, when you're trying to build your own kind of philosophy and you're building your own way that you'd like to do things?
Well, I'll back up to Coach Tark. When he came in, or when I got there, they had a brand new player on campus, and it's amazing how life lines up. But and when I was in college, I actually played New Mexico State. I played football, and one of my roommates was a guy named David Ryder. And in comes the door. Here comes his little brother, J.R. Ryder, walks into UNLV, into the North Gym the first day I was there. I said, "I can't believe this. I would live with your brother, and now here we are together." So what I learned from Tark, from Gerg, was that you get the most talent out of guys. You got to coach them up, coach them hard, hold them accountable, but also understand that these are young kids, and young kids make young mistakes. That big thing is to correct them, don't do them again. With Rolly, the way that Coach Mass, he constructed that Villanova team that won the championship, the last one without a shot clock, and he really had a different flavor of basketball. I think from Coach Tark, between the full court pressure that he could put on, and he could just put points on the scoreboard. Well, I love watching that kind of basketball. With Coach Mass, I learned, hey, the tactical side was very important too, especially maybe you didn't have the athletes or the horses that that UNLV was used to have, and he was very good picking other teams apart. And I'd leave out guys. I hate whenever I mention names, I leave other people out. We had Tom Pecora was with Coach Mass as well, and learned so much from him. Those are, some of the best coaches, best people. And certainly, you mentioned Mark Workantine, rest in peace. Mark was one of the greatest people, one of the best recruiters, one of the most really, really deeply intelligent guy, a great thinker about how to put things together. And so, those guys, what they really helped me with, coach, my philosophy came that you can win basketball games with all kinds of different ways, all kinds of different methods, but commit to it, make sure that everybody understands it, communicate well, and don't waver. Don't buck when it gets tough. Stick to your system. And then both those coaches, like I said, with their national championships, I learned a ton about not blinking when it gets tough.
When you got into the NBA, Tommy, and it's the greatest league, I've always said it, and I was with Dallas for about a
Yeah,
year,
sure was.
with Donnie and Donnie Nelson. We had a great run. But as you first got in there, when you were just starting in the NBA, what were some of the things that stood out to you that were very different about the NBA than maybe being around college programs for you? What were the biggest differences that jumped out?
I really felt right away my pull, gravitational pull, was to the players. And you notice right away they have 22 hours on their hand, on their a free time on their hands every day. Well, now it's a little bit more than that, but college guys, they were pretty much accountable throughout the day. Wake up, they got the team breakfast, they got walkthroughs, they got school, obviously study hall, and their days were pretty structured. NBA, you come to practice, and after that it's your own. And I realized how, but this is way back when I first came in. My first players were Dikembe Mutombo, Alfonso Ellis, Bryan Williams, Bison Dele. There was a lot of great vets, Bryant Stith, and they were grown-up men. And that was awesome. Those guys really kind of helped me so much learn the NBA. But as I stayed in the NBA got younger and younger and younger, to the point where we'd get in high school right to the NBA. So having to teach life skills, having to meet people at the door and really embrace them for, hey, this is a journey. Don't think that you're going to come in and take over the league the first year. Those things really, really kind of, it was an evolution. When I got in 94, there was a lot, the league was a lot older. There was a lot more veteran players. But I'll always thank my rookie, my first year, I was his rookie too, was Jalen Rose. And Coach, you'll laugh at this. Well, we had a press conference for Jalen when he signed and, gave him his jersey, the whole thing. And I was like, look, Jalen, this room's crowded. I don't want you to be freaked out when you walk in there. And he reopened the door and he looked at me and goes, psh, I was at two Final Fours, man. This ain't nothing. And then we had more people at practice, but he made a great point to me. But Jalen was a fantastic rook and he's a fantastic person, fantastic player, great career. But that helped me a lot. You start to realize it, the world isn't exactly where how you see it or where you saw it from. You got to go out and really learn. And I love the league. I learn all the players and where they're from and what the global game. Being with Mutombo my first year and his love for Africa and all the things that came through that. And realizing back then there was less than 20, 30 players in the NBA that were international. Now it's a quarter, and I think it's going to be a third soon, Coach. I really do.
When you were in Denver during that stretch, Tommy, and you were, getting into the NBA and you're kind of, establishing yourself as well, did you have a guy or two that you look back on now that was an older veteran? Well, let me rephrase it. Two questions. How important was it for the young guys to have those high character vets? And if so, who were some of those guys in those early years for you?
Man, I tell you, when you talk about work ethic and unbelievable shooters, I was so blessed to be around Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf and Dale Ellis, Ricky Pierce. Those guys came in and they just show young guys how to work. And if the young guys bucked at all, they would bust their ass right there, Coach. Those guys had no problem playing basketball, playing hard. And we had so many athletes that, a guy like Robert Pack didn't get drafted. And he played in the finals for Portland,
Great
and we
player.
had him there. And LaPhonso Ellis was just such a true gentleman. Brian Stitt, those guys, they were still young. They were the first team ever to beat an 8 seed, beat a one when they beat the Seattle Supersonics, and then they took the Utah Jazz to game seven the following series. But they were just such an amazing amalgam of all these kind of discarded pieces, honestly. Ernie or Bernie Bickerstaff had got Brian Williams off the scrap heap, Reggie Williams off the scrap heap, a couple guys here and there, pieced them together around some rooks. Had Dikembe was going into his third season, and they really took off. So for me, that everybody was a veteran darn near when I got there, except for Jalen. My first year, we went to the playoffs. It was amazing. A lot of great things happened that year. But that's where I actually learned the other side of the league, Coach. And I know how you're going to cringe when I say this, but boy, when those injuries come, at the end of that season, LaPhonso Ellis, people were talking about him being the next mailman, and
That's
his
right.
knee—he had a real bad knee injury that season, and it was up and down, and then he tore an Achilles, and just that's one of my all-time favorite players, favorite people, but that injury changed the trajectory of his career.
Yeah,
So,
for
I
sure.
always tell players, boy, that guaranteed money, man, it's hard to turn that down, fellas, because
Yeah.
if you get injured, it's not going to be guaranteed after that, I promise. So
Yep, yep.
those guys I learned so much from, and the league just keeps giving.
Let's, because I want to hear your story, but I'm going to pick on you on one thing right here or ask you a
Please do.
question. First of all, LaPhonso, he's probably one of the best human beings I've ever been around in my life. We got to be really good friends at ESPN for a couple of years. He's to this day, and I get text messages on my birthday. I get text messages all the time. He's one of the best people I've ever been around. But what I really want to ask you is, I can remember, I'm going to tell you a real fast story. I got cut by Detroit 1987 or 88, and I went back to Mobile, Alabama, and there was a high school basketball tournament. And this team out of Mississippi rolled into University of South Alabama, and they had this young guy named Chris Jackson. And
Yes, sir.
I had just left camp with Isaiah, Joe Dumars, Vinnie Johnson, and now I'm sitting in this high school gym, and I'm watching this high school kid, and I'd never seen anything like it. I'd never seen anything like it. The guy that could shoot it off the dribble and make plays and score and talk a little bit about his talent level, because I tell
Yeah.
people all the time, we're watching Steph Curry, who's going to go down as one of the greatest of all time, his shooting, whatever. But if you go back now, Chris Jackson, well, I call him Chris Jackson, but talk about him a little bit and how good he was. when you were watching him in person in those early years?
Oh man, Mahmoud, you know, Phil Jackson caught a little grief when he mentioned it one time. Said, hey, every time I watch Steph Curry, I remember Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf. And
That's
first
it.
thing I tell you is as good as he was as a player, he was a better person. I loved him. He's a sweet guy and still doing amazing things down in Atlanta in player development and his community. But as a player, I was just every day was he'd do something so effortlessly that nobody could repeat. And his shooting games with Dale Ellis, you know, it didn't count if the net moved. It's amazing. Like these guys would sit out there forever shooting, and just to try to make each other better. You know, Dale Ellis, one of the all-time NBA greatest shooters, 3-point shooters. And so, what was amazing with Mahmoud was just his ability to pull from anywhere, his ability to get anywhere out on the court. He had such a quick handle. You know, he had Tourette's syndrome, and that was well documented. And he would credit it sometimes for his perfectionism. What he needed to do, he couldn't leave the court until it felt right, until it felt perfect. And I thought that's somewhere that took something that maybe was a big challenge and turned it into such a positive. And it was so fun going to arenas with kids, little guys that would show up that had Tourette's. And he would always take the time, always meet with them. And he was a big person to uplift others. But man, when it was showtime, go time, he was unbelievable as a scorer. Wow. I mean, lethal. And it was some of the best games I remember were usually on the road, and they were usually with the Jazz because Stockton and Hornacek would try to go out and guard him. And then he'd get past them, and there was not anybody that really wanted to jump out at him. He would just drain from anywhere.
Yeah, unbelievable. People forget, you know, he went on the road as a freshman in college, went on the road to Florida and put 50 on him. 50, 5-0. Like, people forget that, you know, and how good he was. So talk a little bit, Tommy, about then, you know, you had a great run at Denver, and then you have the opportunity to make the move. And talk a little bit about, you know, that decision and how it came about for you to end up in Washington.
You know, I think that's just one of those things in the NBA. As you go through, you meet people and maybe they become advocates of you. And there was an opportunity when Michael Jordan retired and did not return to the front office or ownership group of the Wizards. Ernie Grunfeld came in, and I'll never forget it. I knew Ernie a little bit in passing. We had some mutual friends, but he had heard that I'd love to get over full time into the front office and do some stuff. And I flew out. Actually, he was vacationing in Aspen. I flew over from Denver. We sat down, had a lunch, and talked for several hours. And it just really felt like this could be a great relationship, great partnership moving forward. And Ernie was tremendous for me. And so I got that opportunity. He said, hey, I heard you always want to run a team. You know, you come to D.C., I'll show you how. And he sure did. He was fantastic for me.
Wow. How about for you, Tommy, too, once you're kind of in that role where, you know, out scouting, you're learning, you're evaluating players, you're learning about, you know, what it is you really like and want when you're going to try to build a team. And then you get into Washington, and your first years, you got to make some changes and you got to get the roster right. But talk about what you personally like. I mean, we all see talent. Everybody can see the best player. Okay, that guy's really talented. But on top of that, what were you hunting for that maybe made a difference in the fact that I want that guy to be in our organization? What were some of those things?
I think that's a great point, Coach, because, man, most of the time your very best player is not your best leader. So I was always looking for people that can be connectors, guys that can sit next to the guy that really has all the weight on his shoulders and take that weight off just by being the human being that he was. And you know, I give Ernie credit. He signed Gilbert Arenas his first summer, and Gilbert came in, and that was okay. Now I'm going to say another one. He was James Harden before James Harden.
Yes,
Gilbert,
he was.
He could flat out light it up, fill it up, do anything from anywhere. And he had had a relationship previously with Antoine Jameson. They played together at Golden State, and Antoine was actually in Dallas, was the sixth man of the year that year, the one year he was there, and we had done some inquiries at trade deadline, and it kind of came up, hey, Antoine Jameson, we went back and forth, we didn't get the deal done, but then that summer, right before the draft, we traded a top pick along with some other pieces, but to get Antoine to came in, him and Gilbert Arenas, so those guys rode through several all-star games, and we went to several playoffs and had some amazing, memorable series because of them. So now, Antoine was definitely one of those kind of guys that we looked for. His character, obviously his talent was there. But coach, I was always somebody that really believed it's really hard to be a superstar in the NBA. It's lonely. And you want to make sure you get people in there that can kind of keep manage the locker room, manage the young people, manage the noise, and help that player just be able to focus on basketball.
Tommy, when you know, most people they don't really understand, you know, the role maybe. You know, they look and say, okay, he's the general manager, he's gonna put the team together. And it's not as easy as that. You know, you got salary caps, you've got contracts expiring, you've got young kids coming up, you've got, you know, all those things. And so how did you kind of, you know, you got to balance all those. You know, every decision is not as easy as people might think it is. Well, hey, let's go get this guy and let's go get that guy. And a lot of times people don't realize there's not very many guys that you can actually go get in the NBA because they're under contract or somebody might not be giving them up. Or, but a lot of those decisions, just talk about all of that when you got to put all that together and how that makes those decisions a little bit more difficult than people realize.
Yeah, I think that the first thing I got to tell you, the biggest responsibility, in my opinion, for the general manager, obviously you got to help put the team together, but it's really being there for the head coach. The head coach of an NBA team is the hardest job by far in the NBA, by far. And every day, front facing and every single decision, second guessed by everybody, every fan has been a Hall of Fame coach in their mind. And it's that person needs the most support by far. So I always look at the GM's job is to make sure you and the coach touching every day, make sure that you understand how the team's operating, why the decisions he made, and then give him all the support possible. And a lot of times I think it's really important to be present at practices so you can have that third set of eyes on something, because a coach sees something, a player sees something, and maybe you can help get that situation resolved or dispute maybe sometimes that pop up. But I think putting a team together starts with what's the vision? How do you want to play? And what can we sustain and what's available to us? You know, and you're right, there's a lot of people who pull out the book every year and say, okay, who likes LeBron? You know, how can we go get Kevin Durant? You know, those kinds of conversations that happen. And it's funny, but you got to say, okay, who do we have and how can we play? What can we play to our strengths? How can we hide our weaknesses and how can we add to this? And there's been some amazing people over the years. We made a trade one year for Marcin Gortat, came in and changed our future. He just 5 years he was cranking in the middle and got a screen named after him. You know, just that one person was so additive. Markieff Morris was another guy that came in and gave us some toughness, and he really helped Beal and Wall learn to be tough. But then all of a sudden we rode in with Paul Pierce. It's just such a there's so many players, if you remember, sometimes the uniforms don't match up with their legacy. You don't really remember Pierce when he was with the Wizards, but he helped us win big playoff game, made a buzzer beater. But just the joy he gave Bradley and John Wall, he gave those guys permission. We went up to Toronto and ran them, but we swept them in the first round. You know, those guys really followed his lead. And I saw firsthand when you get guys that genuinely love basketball and have a great legacy, if you can grab them, grab them. You know, we had guys like Paul Pierce, guys like Andre Miller. They come in finishing up towards the end of their career and they could spread so much of their knowledge, but also could play. You know, you could throw them out there, they'd get you a couple buckets, always going to get a couple whistles from refs. And, you know, those kinds of things, coach, they really help you as you're trying to build teams. Don't forget about those connective pieces.
Tommy, did you ever I always used to tell our players, you know, that I coached, and I had a lot of guys play in the NBA, and one guy that always used to stand out to me, and I love him, he's like a son to me, is Mo Williams, you know, and he had a great run and all throughout the league. But I always tell people, I use him as an example, and I want your take on this one, because I used to tell guys that, you know, being a pro is one thing, but then learning how to be a pro, and I think that extends careers. Like all of a sudden, a guy that's maybe an 8 or 9 year guy turns it into 10 or 11 or 12, or even a second or third year player getting that next contract. But when you're the general manager and you've got some of these young guys you've drafted, you've watched them, you've invested into them, you're also trying to teach them how to be a pro. Not just how to play pro basketball, but your lifestyle and your training and your diet, and how do you extend and how do you get along with the head coach, and, you know, are you a coachable guy? All those type things. Talk a little bit about that and how you saw, or if you even agree or disagree with that. But I always felt from my perspective, that's one lesson I always wanted to try to teach guys that were getting into the league.
Well, modeling behavior is everything. I mean, you
Yeah.
hit on Mo Williams. I mean, you're talking about one of the classiest players who could play in any system, smart as a whip. And I do believe there's quite a few people in the NBA following his coaching career now and seeing where he takes this. Because I think he'll come to the NBA and makes a huge impact for one time when he's ready to. I think he's learning his craft. He's probably enjoying the age group he works with and stuff. But that call of the wild is real, coach. That NBA comes calling and they'll find him and see all the things that he does to connect. It's amazing. I tell you what, we were talking before we got on here about some of these young players coming up. I think we counted 43 legacy players that are in high school now that their daddies played in the NBA during my career. And we're looking forward to seeing them. And, those kinds of players, when their kids come up, you know a couple of things about them. You know they're going to work hard. You know they know the game and they're not going to be intimidated. And those are the legacy players. You look around the NBA, Steph Curry being one of the exhibit A's of
That's right.
guys
That's
that
right.
really weren't too wowed at being into the NBA their first year because they've been around it their whole life. And that's what I'm looking forward to. But a guy like Mo Williams, man, his savvy, his presence, his ability to he enters any room and everybody stands up a little bit
That's right.
straighter,
That's right.
and that's respect. And those guys do mean a lot. And there's a lot of guys that probably have 5 years of service longer than they should have because of their talent was leaving, but their character kept them there. And those are the ones we hold up as examples.
You mentioned, and we talked about Mo, and I've known Mo obviously, and he coached with me. I got him started in coaching and all that. But boy, when I coached him, Tommy, he never had a bad day. Like if you look back and you see guys that walk in the gym every day, smile on their face, have great enthusiasm. They want to be coached. He wanted to be coached. And he was the national freshman of the year. Like people forget that in college basketball, he was the best freshman in the country, but he's just got so much character, and we stay in touch all the time. But those are the guys too, in my view, like Mo. And I used to say Mo went from Charlotte, Minnesota, he bounced around Cleveland. I mean, and he got the big deal, I think, in Minnesota, but he never got away from who he was as a player and as a person and his character. And I think those are the guys that end up being able to turn their career into, I think he got 15 years, maybe paid his 16th year. He didn't play, but I think 15. But, those are the guys I'm sure for you that you enjoyed watching their journeys, as they journeyed through through the league.
Oh, absolutely. And you pull for him like heck. It's tough enough you got to play against him 4 times a year when I was out west. And, but once you're done playing those 4 games, you look at the box score of some of my favorite players in the league and you trace them and see how they're doing. And man, I tell you what, your school has had a lot of talent come through the NBA. Some of my most favorite guys, Antonio McDyess, Roy Rogers, all those cats could just flat out go. They were unbelievable. And I don't think it's a mistake that's most of those guys that I enjoy playing and following and watching them. But their character was always resonant. That they were always present after a game, the first people to talk, and just great, great guys. And I always think about those kind of people, and they're so coachable to your point. And you look at some of the guys Mo played for, every one of those coaches probably they'd rather cut a starter than cut Mo because they know,
That's
hey,
right.
at least I
That's
got
right.
him.
That's right. That's right. Tommy, you've had great players and you've had great moments, but then you've had tough moments too. Like when you're a GM, it's part of the turf. We all deal with this. Like being a head coach, you got, these great moments, and then you got to deal with some stuff. You had some of those too in Washington, and obviously, the guys in the locker room, the one, issue there with the guns and all that. But, when you're sitting in your seat, talk about dealing with some of that, because you're not talking about dealing with a 17-year-old now. This is a different level. But talk about your role in handling some of those tougher times as well as some of the good times.
Yeah, I think you just have to, leadership can't have a bad day, to your point earlier, and you've got to approach everything with open arms. What happened? What's the information? Who needs to know? And how are we going to resolve this? And you got to kind of approach now. I think ever since the smartphones came out, I don't think there's a single day that I ever thought, hey, we got to keep this quiet. It's going to get out.
Oh,
How
yeah.
are you going to manage your message? And I think being transparent, brutally honest is something that served me well throughout my career. Yeah, the tough days are hard for me emotionally for what may be at stake for that player. Because it is so freaking hard to make the NBA. It's easier to win Powerball than it is to play one game in the NBA. You don't want to see something off the court cost a guy his career. And I've seen that, unfortunately. It breaks your heart because this is generational wealth. It's something that they could really, really be a great example to lift other people up. And if someone messes up bad enough and they're not invited back to the NBA, that's heartbreaking for me. So I think those decisions usually, they're not as hard as people make them out to be, because like, hey, here's the facts. What happened? And if it's not going to fly with the NBA, it's not going to fly in the court system, then it's not going to fly here, obviously. But I think we always tried to make sure that you get all the information. Because players, boy, I tell you, there's such a huge society on the other side of the glass looking at them and wanting them to, certainly they want to see them succeed, but then a lot of people don't. They like to knock you off that pedestal or see you struggle. And that's sad. That really is a sad day. But sports are supposed to uplift people. So when athletes, they're not perfect people, just like people aren't perfect people. They have a bad day. You and I can have a bad day right now. We come home, nobody really knows about it. They can have a bad day, and it's known in about
That's the
2 minutes.
whole world. Yeah,
And it'll
whole
take you
world.
2 seconds to do something and 20 days to live it down. So I think the hard thing for me, Coach, when you got to see those things happen, it's just knowing their families and knowing who's going to be impacted. When a player's traded, when a coach is fired, when a GM's fired, you're firing everybody in their family that you ever met, all their friends, everything. And it's ugly. It's messy. It hurts. So those things, as a GM, those are really tough, haunting decisions. I always found it harder for the guy that was retiring than maybe cutting a young guy. Young guys, they'll learn. They'll get back to the NBA. But when a vet player is retiring, that just means the phone didn't ring, and that's hard. It's hard to let those guys go.
Tommy, I've got some good friends, obviously, been, GMs. Obviously, I coached Bob Myers for 4 years, and he had a great run at Wash, I mean, at Golden State. And one of my best friends used to be the GM for the Arizona Cardinals in the NFL. We talk about a lot. How important do you think, Tommy, like the relationship between the head coach and you? Because, I was a head coach in college. I wasn't ever a head coach in the NBA, but in college, my relationship with the AD, although they're not, they got 17 sports. They're not just one sport. So how important for you, like that communication, the relationship, or even if you looked around through the league, you looked at other teams, is that for you, is that an important thing, obviously, between because you and the head coach have to, whether it's who you're going to play. Hey, we drafted this guy. You're not playing him. Hey, I just traded for this guy. Boy, we got to get him in the lineup somehow. I mean, how does that work, or how did it work for you?
Every day, coach, that's the most important relationship a GM can have is with the coach. I promise. But my wife would tease me. She's like my work wife. But we would have conversations on and on into the night. Every coach, as an assistant, when I was an assistant GM, when I was the GM, the coach is your first call in the morning, first call or last call at night. And you're there, and it's fun when you win a game, especially on the road, and especially a playoff game on the road. Those are unbelievable, but they never cover the lows of losing a game or losing a, player gets hurt for the year and something changes. Like those low moments, a coach needs 100% support around them. And I think that's our responsibility. And if you really care about your franchise, it's got to start with that relationship right there. And it's really important that communication is collaborative every day, but it's genuine, it's authentic, and it's not always about basketball. And I think those are the hardest departures when a coach leaves the door. Leaves the building, you're still in the building. It's the relationship's never going to quite be the same. It hurts, but this where they say dogs bark, babies cry, but the circus moves on. That's kind of the NBA in a nutshell. But you hate it because hey, these relationships. During the season, we never want to admit this, but we're with our teams, we're with our coaches more than we are with our families.
That's right.
And man, when that it's one day you're there, 364, and that 365th day they get traded or moved or fired, and it's like the relationship's never the same. It's crazy.
Tommy, if you were to sit down, and you probably have, I'm sure there are young guys that come to you and maybe ask you for advice. But, if there's a young GM, he gets put in that, or he gets, it's a job of a lifetime. He gets hired. Yeah. He's the new GM of the whichever team in the NBA. And you had a chance just to sit with them, and you had a couple minutes. What are some kind of nuggets that you would say, if they came and said, Tommy, help, give me some advice. What are some things that you would share with them from all the experiences that you had throughout your career?
So much everything for me is tell me about the relationship you have with each player. Mm. Tell me what you know about this person in your organization that doesn't have anything to do with basketball. Let's start there. Because if you don't, you're never going to really be in that player circle, their sphere. You're never going to be able to orbit around them and help them, because they know this is transactional. It's not personal. Relationships to the NBA players, they're watching every single thing you do every day. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you another one, Coach. You can fool everybody but kids, horses, mm-hmm. and NBA players, right? Like they're going to know how genuine you are in your relationship. So mm-hmm. I always try to really – I've spent quite a bit of time with a lot of GMs the last 2 years trying to help them off that ledge or, talking through some stuff, and especially mm-hmm. trade deadlines and stuff. And it's always comes mm-hmm. back to relationships. Just be authentic, be genuine, be transparent, but be present. There's a ministry of being present that really, really matters to people. Okay. Because every night, right, when we go out, the outcome of these events in our lives tend to be printed in the paper and first highlight on ESPN. And sometimes it doesn't go their way, and that's a lonely time. And just having that ability to pick people up, dust them off, get back up. I love that Luke Combs song that's out right now, the backup plans to get back up. That should be played in every NBA locker room, man, because every night somebody won, somebody lost, and the ability to just keep getting back up, I think it speaks to the character of your players, and it's the tone set by the coach and staff, and the GM helps select that, and it all works together. So GMs, I go very hard at them. Know the name of their dog. Know the name of their kids. Know their mom. Where are they from? Go to their hometown. Who did they play for in high school? Who's their favorite player? What's their favorite food? You start acquiring those kinds of knowledge. You can come at a player in adverse moments. I think they know, hey, you're in my life. You spend enough time. I'm giving you permission to be in my life. And that there's only one way to get in there is if they let you in. And the only way they're going to let you in is that they genuinely trust you.
Yeah. How about in pro sports, as a general manager, how important is your relationship with the owner?
It's so critical. And I think right now is such a different time in the NBA. When I came into the NBA 30 years ago to now, I think there's only 3 or 4 teams that are still owned by the same people. Wow. And several of them have been sold several times. So I think the ownership group is so critical to the success of the team and how they want. But it's all about, but when I was the assistant GM, my job was to manage down and take care of the draft, take care of free agency, take care of the day-to-day stuff. Mm-hmm. So the GM can manage up. And when you manage up, you're managing straight to ownership, who has to, that they all have groups now, and they have to keep everybody informed and keep everybody on point. And they're setting the message, setting the tone. But managing expectations is huge. And I can cite some places, and you probably understand what I'm talking about, where maybe the ownership takes the lead in setting the tone for the team. And maybe the team can't ever aspire to those kinds of expectations. Maybe they just need to take a step back and say, hey, we're developing, instead of saying we're going to win a championship this year.
Right.
Because
right.
when you don't, I haven't seen an owner yet fire himself. So it goes downhill pretty quick. So, you got to be in line. You have to be in step. And you have to understand that they're going to be with you win or tie. So you better make sure you do a great job of communicating every day.
Mm-hmm. Tommy, was there a acquisition, whether trade, draft, doesn't really matter where. And we've had them as coaches. I've signed players that sometimes I think they're going to be the greatest player and they kind of don't pan out. I've signed some guys that, we just kind of took them, at the very end. Like, I kind of in my gut have a little bit of hunch on this guy, and I'm going to sign him. And all of a sudden that guy, kind of exceeds. But was there a move you made that you kind of look back on now, like, And we're all being honest, you know, hey, I've had guys that I didn't think were going to be that great that turned out to be unbelievable. But was there somebody that you said, I think I got that one right, and or I stumbled into it, or but like one of the stories that maybe like, you know, on the high end, and because we've all had some where they haven't panned out. But talk sure. to me about maybe if you look back, give me one or two of those where you would say, there we go. That one was, we got that one done, and we got it done the right way.
Yeah, and you're right when you say we, because there's never one person that does the draft. There's one person who turns it in. And that's what I always laugh when we put all the hands up, and I always say, okay, who's cool if we get fired if this doesn't work out? And you see a few hands go right back down. But I do think, you know, over the course of 30 years, there's so many guys that were so additive that, you know, like a guy like Bobby Jackson, when I was in Denver, he obviously thrived other places after he left Denver. But when we drafted him, you know, kind of out of nowhere in terms of what was expected of him. And he was such a fantastic kid, great, great player. And I would also, you can go right down the line. There's so many players like that. James Posey was a great draft pick for us in Denver. You go to Washington, there were some trades that we made where sometimes it was a guy that got thrown in that ended up being something else. And sometimes a guy like Deshaun Stevenson, who got trapped in free agency one year, didn't get paid here. So he was left there and Rob Pelinka, his agent at the time, and Ernie hooked up, and we were able to add him. And Deshaun was just tremendous in those years where we were battling with Cleveland and Chicago and stuff in the playoffs. A great defender, a great teammate, perfect fit. I mentioned Antoine, Gortat. Now, there's so many guys. Now you're asking me to pick between my favorite kids. You know, I got seven kids, and they're all my favorite. So I would think one of the most outstanding for me personally, it wasn't as much of a player as what he made in my life was Sharunas Marcellonas. That's actually when we traded Mark Mood to Sacramento after Mark Mood had an incident involving the American flag and the national anthem. Ownership asked for him to move on. And we end up with Sharunas in 96 in Atlanta. And that became that's my brother for life. We ended up doing a lot of business together. We shared a basketball academy. We did a lot of things together. Over the years, to this day, he's a one phone call away guy I talk to probably every other week of my life. And so, you know, guys come into your life through basketball, certainly, but some of them leave footprints after basketball. He'd be one of them. And I'm always real proud of, you know, guys that went through, that were players, and then now they're coaching. And their ability to really kind of see the difference. And now they understand why coaches were so crazy, how hard they work. But I love this part of life, Coach, where all your old players are calling you for advice and the careers and what they want to do and hearing, celebrating and telling you their great success stories. And like we mentioned earlier, you know, John Wall's retirement. I remember the first day he walked into our gym. I remember the first time I saw him. And now to see him as a parent and what he's going to do post-career, I'm excited for him. But time just keeps marching on. So I can imagine we'd sit here and talk about players and some of the guys I know that you coach. Man, life was pretty darn good.
You know, and for me, Tommy, that was always – I mean, I love to win, and I was – we all do. We all want to win, and we're all competitive. But those relationships that you build and you build with those players throughout the years, and then they get older. You know, I got some guys now that are in their mid-40s, you know, that I coached as a head coach. And just to see where they are, and I'm sure you feel the same way. You know, you see guys come in, and they mature, and they get older, and all of a sudden – you've watched them develop, you know, as people. And that to me was always probably some of the most fun and that was the most rewarding for me. You know, I mean, we all want to win desperately, but those relationships, like you mentioned, and that obviously for you, you can tell that's something that for you that just resonates, you know, deep in your soul. That's part of your fabric. So, talk about that a little bit and just how important that was for you.
Well, just when I got to Denver, that was an all NBA player and defensive player of the year was Dikembe Mutombo, and his absolute thirst to make his home country back then in Zaire, now it's the Congo, to change the lives of others, to lift up his country. Through his platform that basketball gave him made such a huge impression on me. And then every international player moving forward from there, I always saw that extra responsibility they felt to do things here in the NBA, to make an impression, certainly to represent their country, but to be able to uplift people from when I was in Denver. I had Nene. We brought Nene to Washington, seeing what he was able to do for basketball in Brazil. And I could go down and down, Gortat, what he did in Poland. There's so many people. But then I look at a guy, one of the most biggest footprints of my heart was Joe Wolf. When Joe Wolf came in a really bad year in Denver, and all he did was be professional, saved our season in terms of just making sure, because we had nothing but rookies that year. And Bill Hanzik was the coach, and it was a very difficult year. One of the years we actually were the Philadelphia 76ers vets back in the day when they won 12 games, were calling us hoping that we didn't win another game kind of deal. It was 10 games, and we actually ended up winning 12 that year. But Joe Wolf was on that team, an unbelievable vet. Followed his whole career, one of my dearest friends. And this summer we lost Dikembe, and see everything that Dikembe did for the world and basketball. But then also very, very heartbreaking for me, as much as Dikembe, that loss was losing Joe Wolf and the impression and all the impact he made on lives of people in Wisconsin, North Carolina, anywhere he went. So you don't have to be a superstar for people to remember you as a superstar person. And I think both of those guys, when I think of great, great dudes that I couldn't say enough about and their impact on my life and the impact on the lives of others. Dikembe Mutombo is a worldwide name, but so Joe Wolf's he's his name is big in my world.
Oh, no doubt.
Yes,
No
both
doubt.
of them daily.
Yeah. Tommy, talk about this for a second real quick, because I got fired, and it's part of the turf, even though the fans don't realize how difficult it is. The first answer is always fire the coach. Fire the coach. That'll solve the problem. But when you're in there and in your role too as a GM, it happens. It's part of sports. But when it happened to me, I originally thought, my world was ending. It's over. But then you realize and you start to get pick yourself back up, and you understand, and you don't. Sometimes I felt like I was walking around with the scarlet letter on my forehead. It's like, okay, but people don't view you that way. It's like the respect you have around the league, but it's still hard. It's still difficult, and it's still hard. Talk about kind of what you learned maybe through that process when an organization decides, hey, we're just going to make a change. We're going to go in another direction.
It was the first time in my entire life going back to yard work and moving forward that I ever lost a job. So it was heartbreaking. It was stunning. But at the same time, I understood this, right? Whenever I was delivering the news, whenever one of my friends got fired, I was the first call. I would always call them and we'd catch up, and I'd have a whole kind of it wasn't rehearsed, but from the heart, hey, these are the things that I think we really need to work on and how we can do this and stuff. So when it happened to me, I was like, oh, hell. Now I have to do all that stuff I've been telling people to do forever. It was difficult, but it pulls you together. The only thing I worried about in that old time is my family. How hard it is, because kids got friends at school, and they're no
It's
dummies, and they
tough.
hear stuff. And people, mean people suck. There's a reason that we say that. And but at the same time, I was like, look, man, this is sports. This isn't the real world. This is a
Part of the deal.
bubble. We'll be okay. And the biggest thing I know is that I couldn't thank Ted Leonsis enough. He was wonderful to me, gave me a great opportunity. And it was a choppy waters when I took over. It was first thing was COVID, and then we had big trades, and then guys get hurt. But you know what? I checked, man. Nobody cares, right? You got to
That's
move
right.
on. And you pick yourself up. You got a great group of friends. And I think, your story, my story, hopefully those help other people, inspire other people. But man, I could never look forward without just being so grateful. I don't have a bitter bone in my body about it. And I do think, man, no matter what, bro, this is basketball. And what a great place to be when you're in the side of an arena.
No doubt. And I tell people too, Tommy, I root for everybody too. Like I don't want to be a bitter guy. I sat with Bill Self the other day. We were at this thing and I was talking about NC State, and I hope they win, and I'm rooting for Nate Oates at Alabama, all the places. But and he even looked at me and said, man, you're not really bitter about anything. And I was like, no, why would I be? I had an amazing run. I built amazing relationships throughout my career as a coach, and so I'm not going to live that way. And I can tell with your personality, your demeanor, you look back at all of those relationships that we were able to, forge through basketball, and we'll continue to as well in the future. So I think that's a great perspective. So All right, we're going to have a little fun here at the very end. So if you want to pass on an answer, you can pass. So I did this. Me and Thurl Bailey had this great conversation. Mo and I had it on my podcast. Tyler Hansborough. I had Robert Ory. I pinned Robert down. So
nice. Everybody
wants to talk about the GOAT now, Tommy. Who is the GOAT?
You mean besides Michael? Because you know, in Hollywood, all they do is make sequels. So I guess the GOAT Part 2, GOAT Part 3, Part 4. You know, my personal behind Michael, I would always, Tim Duncan doesn't get enough credit. That Joker, all he did was win rings and play his butt off. And if he had a totally different personality in a different market or something, maybe people would look at it a little bit different. I would say, who are my GOATs below? I would have Kobe there, LeBron there, Tim there. But I don't know how any, you know, I'm biased as hell. I told you my favorite player in the world was Julius, but the greatest I ever laid eyes on in 30 years is still Michael. And I still love that when he talked about how they could still, you know, the dream team, the original dream team could still beat any of the teams. And someone's like, well, shit, by how much? You know, Michael said, well, probably one or two, because I am 60 years old now. So I always laugh about that, because that is Michael to a T. He will go out there and still, he could buzz your ears pretty quick.
In my view, it's not close. But I'll tell you, the guy in my view, in my view, Tommy, the guy that just kind of slides by and we don't talk about him enough, and he actually, from where I'm sitting right now, in my chair right now, if I drove about a 1 mile down the road and turned in a neighborhood, he'd be living there, and I always tell people, we're forgetting one here. We're forgetting one.
I'm not Kareem.
And that's Kareem. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. When you look at his I tell young people all the time, look him up. Just look him up. Just roll down through his journey. And, you know, LeBron passed him in scoring. But people forget Kareem played 3 years in college. Or actually, well, he was 4 years in college because his freshman year he couldn't play. Then he played three. So if you had given him 4 more years of NBA basketball, that record would have been untouched. You wouldn't catch it. You wouldn't catch that record. So that's
one of the neat things of working at UNLV. That's actually where he broke the all-time scoring record. You know, the Jazz used to play 16 games a year in Vegas. Mm-hmm. And Kareem broke that there on that court. And there's a great story about that because how scoring tables go in college, they got the same guy for 50 years. And the official score said, Magic walked over before the game, said, if I'm in the game, I get the assist. And that was their deal. Kareem hit a skyhook to get the bucket. But that's how the way you feel about Kareem is the way I feel about Tim. I saw more of Tim's career than Kareem's. Yeah. Obviously, I think Kareem is. He's definitely, yep. I mean, come on.
Yep.
I got like 20 people in my top five.
Yeah.
And all of them, you know, you love. And those conversations go on forever. But when I talk about the most competitive, I will rip your heart out, throw it at your family kind of people, that's a different breed. Those cats right there, there's not that many guys that have that just absolute killer instinct. That's, I'd say Michael, Kobe right there. But there's different ways to win. Yeah. But you're right, absolutely. Yeah. Kareem is one of the all-timers.
I tell people all the time, these young guys say, LeBron. I say, okay, I'm going to ask you a question. If you had to win a game, if you don't win the game, they'll put you in the ground after the game. You have to win the game. There's no who you pick it. And then they go, probably Michael. I said, yeah, it's Michael. All right, here we go with another one. Now, you've been around and you've watched and you've witnessed some phenomenal NBA coaches. I mean, the best of the best now. And this is going to be hard for you. But if you had to hire, if money was no object and you got to hire one guy and you had to win a championship of the coaches, who would that be?
Well, to me, I'd say Pop first before anybody, just because I got a chance to be around and see that.
I like it.
Phil Jackson is pretty amazing, too, obviously. Both of them were blessed. I've been to the Hall of Fame several times, as you have, and you look and you see those great players, and you go, man, that was a great coach. And then you look at the great coaches that are in there, and you go, God, look at all the damn players that played for them. So somewhere in there, they need each other. So I would say, you know, those kinds of questions, I love them because those two really resonate with me. completely different coaches, completely different people. And then all of a sudden you realize you didn't mention Riley. You go, oh hell. And then now all of a sudden now you got Kerr and you got Spo and you got, okay,
That's right.
that's why people get uncomfortable with these things. But my blink answer to you would have been Pop, and it still is. Because by the time if you had to win game seven, you weren't worried about everything that came up to that because his team was going to be in peace and harmony, ready to play.
Yeah, no question. Well, Tommy, we're out of time, man. So I just want to first of all say thank you, man. You've been a you go around the league, there's great, great people in the league, but you were always kind to me. You were always good to me. And
likewise, Coach.
I appreciate you. And I just want to say thank you, man, for taking the time to be on the show today. And this has been a lot of fun. So thank you very much.
Hey, Coach, thank you so much. I look forward to catching up again soon.
We'll do it.
Take care.
All right. Thank you, buddy.
Yes, sir.
All right. Hold on for about 10 seconds here. They'll just make sure.
Hey, I'm coachable. I promise. I remember.